Welcome to ATS Mix.
I think until you start asking questions, you know, you're just going to buy whatever's offered to you on the 6 o'clock news.
ATS Mix.
This isn't a talk show, it's a freak show.
From AboveTopSecret.com.
I'd also be skeptical of the people who are out there selling conspiracy theories.
The Internet's most popular conspiracy theory discussion board. ATS Mix. From AboveTopSecret.com.
In the name of Christ, just let us in!
Starts now.
We were able to coordinate schedules with everybody and be able to finally interview Graham Hancock. And what a great guy he turned out to be.
John, I have to tell you, I broke my own rule. You know me. I don't like listening to other people's interviews because I think it provides some kind of a slant for me. I don't want to hear how other people did it. But I broke down and listened to his interview with Art Bell. No offense, Art, but I got to tell you, I think the members are going to find out that this is one hell of an interview that we did, and not breaking our arm to pat ourselves on the back. But off air, Graham said how much fun he had with this interview and that he really enjoyed the diversity of the membership questions that were thrown his way. So kudos to not only my partner, John, but to all the members, because this is going to be a great, great, great show.
Yeah. And once again, let me just mirror what Dave said. Kudos to the membership here at AboveTopSecret.com. You guys did a great job in coming up with some fantastic questions for Graham, and he mirrored that sentiment also. And you folks are really going to enjoy this. It turned out to be about an hour long after we did the editing, so I think you folks are really going to enjoy this. This is definitely one that you're going to want to put in your ATS Mix treasure trove chest.
He answered things not like in some of the other interviews where he is doing more of a lecture. He really answered these in a condensed form for Johnny and I because he wanted to answer as many questions from the AboveTopSecret.com members as he could. And for those members that their name was not mentioned, when we were scrolling through the question period with him, a lot of the answers were already given to questions that some of you asked, and it would have been redundant to simply ask him again. So please forgive us for not being able to mention everybody's name, and we had 3 pages of questions, but he did address a lot of the things that you asked.
And also, we were on a bit of a time schedule, too. We were only allowed X amount of time with Graham.
Right. And it was nighttime, in his area. So.
And right now, let's not wait anymore. Here it is, our interview with Graham Hancock.
The following is an ATS Mix exclusive interview.
Well, Dave, we have been trying to get this gentleman on our show for, since the inception of the ATS Mix. And
exactly.
I could not be happier right now. Let me tell you about the guests that Dave and I have on the ATS Mix today. Graham Hancock graduated from Durham University with first-class honors in sociology. He then went on to pursue a career in journalism, writing for many of Britain's leading newspapers. He is the author of several bestsellers, including The Sign and the Seal, Fingerprints of the Gods, and Heaven's Mirror. His books have sold more than 5 million copies worldwide and has been translated into 27 languages. Tens of millions of people have been able to be exposed watching his TV appearances, including the 3-hour series Quest for the Lost Civilization. He is known as an unconventional, out-of-the-box thinker who raises interesting questions about our history and challenges the entrenched views of Orthodox scholars worldwide. His latest book is entitled Supernatural, Meetings with the Ancient Teachers of Mankind. And we'd also like to encourage our listeners to pop up his website, which is located at www.grahamhancock.com. The ATS Mix is very honored to have with us right now Graham Hancock. Hello, Graham. How are you, sir?
Hi there. Good to talk to you guys.
We really appreciate you taking the time all the way from overseas over there.
Yes, over on the other side of that huge ocean, here I am.
Hey, we have a lot of friends over in the United Kingdom, so we're excited to have one of our fellow brothers over there spend some time with us today. John, go ahead.
Very good.
One of the questions I want to just start us off with, what on earth was it that motivated a man with honors in sociology to move into archaeology?
Well, it was a series of accidents, in fact. After I left university, I went into journalism. I specialized in Africa, and at the peak of my journalistic career, I was the East Africa correspondent for The Economist, very serious newspaper looking at war, politics, famine, the economies of Africa. I used to travel very widely around the East African region, and particularly to Ethiopia. And in Ethiopia, I came across an amazing tradition. They claim to possess the Lost Ark of the Covenant, as in Raiders of the Lost Ark. And I found myself in a war zone in front of a chapel with a monk who said he was guarding the Ark. And that's when my adventure into ancient history began. I believe me, quite soon after that, I left current affairs far behind.
And did you happen to find out if it was the Ark of the Covenant?
Well, I actually believe that the Ethiopians do have the Ark of the Covenant, and I think it's been in their country for 2,600 years. And you know, part of the adventure of that research was it was a very difficult time to travel in Ethiopia. There was a civil war going on, had to get behind the lines into difficult and dangerous circumstances, get close to some of the mysteries of Ethiopia. For example, why does Ethiopia have a Jewish population that practices an Old Testament form of Judaism, and could this be right. connected to the Ark? And I gradually began to put the pieces together, found a realistic route that the Ark could have come into Ethiopia, and got as close as I could get without actually getting killed to seeing the object itself. Because, you know, I mean, the sacred city of Aksum in northern Ethiopia is heavily guarded, and its whole purpose is to look after this relic that they believe, and I believe, is the Ark of the Covenant.
Well, you're a certified diver, and I was an instructor for PADI, the Professional Association of Diving Instructors, and we both have a passion for diving. Yours was cave diving. I also got a certification in cave diving as an instructor. Can you tell me about some of your experiences when you used to do cave diving?
I should clarify. It wasn't only or even mainly cave diving. Although I have dived in a number of caves, and as you with experience in this area will know, that's very risky and dangerous work, or it can be, especially if there's silt and mud in the water, which you can stir up and get yourself lost inside a cave. You need to take very, very careful precautions in caves. But the majority of diving that I've done has been down to depths of 120 feet all around the world, and primarily with the purpose of finding out whether there could be any structures underwater, ruins that have been covered by rising sea level. A good part of my career as an author, I have looked into the possibility of could there have been a lost civilization. And my book, Fingerprints of the Gods, and a later book, Underworld, dealt with this problem very, very directly. And my case has been that if we are looking for a lost civilization, we need to look for it about 12,000 years ago at the end of the last ice age, when the face of the earth changed completely and sea levels rose by more than 400 feet, swallowing 10 million square miles of land. That's Europe and China added together. Equivalent land area went under the water at the end of the last ice age. And archaeologists really haven't looked under the water for the ruins of a lost civilization. So I've spent a lot of time, and some of it particularly fruitfully, in Japanese and Taiwanese waters, but also off the coast of India, and in the Mediterranean and in the Pacific, looking for and finding underwater ruins that don't fit the prevailing view of history.
Well, you were talking about finding some of these structures and whatnot underneath the ocean. There is, I guess, some stone monuments that I guess were as large as Stonehenge, some 120 feet below the surface of the ocean off the coast of Japan that I guess that you had
investigated. I've put in hundreds of dives on those monuments, and I've played some part in bringing them to the attention of the world, because it's really a great enigma what we find off the coast of Japan. And I have indeed dived on a stone circle off the Kerama group of islands, about 40 miles west of the main island of Okinawa, down to a depth indeed of 120 feet. There's a gigantic stone circle there, definitely man-made. There's absolutely no doubt about it whatsoever, cut out of solid rock and on an absolutely epic scale. And it's part of a series of underwater monuments in the area. Truly takes the breath away. But because there's such a strong view in archaeology that they, you see, this monument at 120-foot depth has been underwater, we know from the geology without a shadow of a doubt, it's been underwater for more than 12,000 years. And the prevailing view of history is that there was no civilization capable of creating a monument on that scale 12,000 years ago. Therefore, the monument itself rewrites history. And this has led to a lot of controversy within archaeology. And unfortunately, although there are diving archaeologists, their primary interest is shipwrecks, not ruins. And this site has never really had the attention from archaeology that it deserves.
All right, now I'm going to go into an area that I know you are extremely passionate about. It is your hot button, if you will. And it has to do with something that I became really intrigued with when I first saw this movie called Altered States, which was back in 1980. And basically, it delved into an area of using hallucinatory drugs and sensory deprivation situation to go deeper into your life. And I know that you have a huge passion about this subject. And if you would just take a few minutes and tell our listeners what you have experienced in the shamanism area.
Yes. This is absolutely central to the theme of my latest book, which is supernatural. And I never imagined when I began to research that book that I was going to end up traveling to the Amazon and taking powerful hallucinogenic plants. I had no idea that I was going to be doing that. I thought I was going to be looking at the mystery of human origins. But it turned out that this mystery, and particularly the mystery of the origins of modern human behavior and the fantastic symbolism and art and spirituality of modern human beings, it turns out, and there's really no doubt about this, I don't want to give a long, boring explanation to your listeners, but there's no doubt that it was the experience of altered states of consciousness brought on by hallucinogenic plants by our ancestors that led them to create the first great art, the art of the painted caves of southern Europe, which goes back 35,000 years, and took them out of a very long period of incredibly boring behavior and turned them into spiritual creatures that clearly believed in life after death, who started to bury their dead with grave goods, with food and with water, clearly confident that some essence of the individual continues on after death. And this was really a huge moment in the human story, and it happened less than 40,000 years ago. And academic opinion is agreed that it was the work of shamans,
right,
who were altering their consciousness primarily by the use of hallucinogenic plants and entering what they experienced as spirit worlds and then returning from those spirit realms and painting what they saw on the walls of the caves. Now, as a former journalist, I've always believed that I should experience what I'm writing about.
Right.
And since it became clear that hallucinogens had played such a crucial role in the birth of art and religion amongst humanity, and since there are still shamanistic cultures around the world that use these plants, I decided that I had to immerse myself in that. So I went down to the Amazon, where they have a most extraordinary brew called ayahuasca, which means the vine of souls or the vine of the dead.
Right.
It's a mixture of two plants. It tastes absolutely horrendous. It is, you really have, nobody should imagine that taking these plants is done for kicks. You know, this is something that you absolutely have to brace yourself for it. You're going to vomit. You're going to have diarrhea. You're going to be very dizzy. But through it all, with these terrible difficulties that your body is going through, which really requires strength of will, through it all, you are plunged into an absolutely seamlessly convincing parallel world at the level of your consciousness. And you can absolutely understand how the notion of spirit worlds, even of heaven and hell, of supernatural beings, because these realms are inhabited, you can understand how it originated. And I've come to realize that there's a great mystery about human consciousness.
Right.
Any honest scientist will tell you this. Scientists do not understand what consciousness is. Or how it works. But it seems to me, and I draw this from now many years of experience with this strange Amazonian brew, that our consciousness normally in day-to-day life is tuned into a very narrow wavelength. This is the alert problem-solving state of consciousness that's useful for us to survive in the hubbub of the modern world. But there are many other kinds of consciousness, and rather as we can retune a TV set to pick up many different signals, it's possible to retune the receiver wavelength of the brain in order to experience a much wider reality, normally invisible to our senses, that surrounds us. And it is this experience of exploring parallel worlds which I have found particularly intriguing and exciting about these shamanic plants, particularly so since people from many different cultures can explore the same worlds in altered states of consciousness. And normally when many people agree on what they've seen, then we accept that that's reality. And I think we have to consider that there is a kind of parallel reality here that we can only explore in altered states of consciousness.
Yeah, I totally agree with you.
I'd like to add a small disclaimer, if I could, that the Above Network LLC and the ATS Mix both are not advocating the use of illicit or illegal drugs. And I believe also, Graham, you also are not advocating people to take drugs.
I'm not advocating the use of drugs at all. One thing I do advocate, however, is adult responsibility.
Right.
I do believe as a matter of political principle, if you like, that adults in an advanced, developed society should be free to explore the mystery of their own consciousness, and that a society which seeks to legislate what we do and do not do with our own consciousness is in danger of invading the sovereignty of the individual in most horrific and unhelpful ways.
Sure.
We must be sovereign over our own consciousness.
And I just have one
going to talk about freedom.
Yeah, I totally agree, and I just have one thing to say about that before I toss it to Johnny, and that is there was a bunch of us in Vietnam that totally agreed with you.
Yeah, absolutely. It makes sense, you know. One of the terrible hypocrisies of the West is that we talk constantly about freedom. When I say the West, I'm referring to Britain, the United States, the whole of the industrialized world, really.
Right.
We talk so much about freedom, and we wish to impose our model of freedom on other cultures, and yet within our own cultures, rooted and grounded in our own cultures, is the most grievous transgression of individual freedom, which is that my society may actually send me to prison for exploring with plants that have been in use in human culture for thousands of years the mystery of my own consciousness. This just cannot be right. If I'm not sovereign over my own consciousness, then I'm not sovereign over anything, and there's no point in talking about any kind of freedom, and let's forget about democracy as well.
Right.
Right. We talked briefly about the monuments that were found underneath the water there, 120 feet below the surface off the coast of Japan. I'm just curious, for there to be such a rise, a level of the ocean to rise, what type of cataclysmic event do you think might have happened for these to actually disappear and get submerged? Do you think global warming was
It's more complicated than that, although certainly it was a global warming of a form. The fact is that scientists don't really know why it happened, but there's universal agreement that it did happen, that there was an ice age, that for more than 120,000 years, most of North America and most of Northern Europe was lying under ice sheets that were 2 miles thick. I mean, you had 2 mile thick ice over New York State, you know, and we had 2 mile thick ice over the city of London in England. And these vast ice caps were stable for more than 100,000 years. And then round about 12,000 years ago, there was a ferocious meltdown. And sea level rose dramatically all around the world. And that was the end of the Ice Age. And after that, the world looked completely different. Britain was joined to mainland Europe at that time. It isn't anymore. You could walk from Siberia into Alaska. Taiwan was joined to the mainland of China. The world was a completely different place. And my argument is that archaeology cannot claim to have got to grips with the whole story of our past if it isn't prepared to look on those areas of land now underwater that were above water more than 12,000 years ago. And that takes diving, and that's why I learned to scuba dive, and why I put myself through literally thousands of dives over 7 years all around the world, because nobody else is doing this work. And, you know, I'm one individual doing it on my own initiative. If there were properly funded institutes which were prepared to search for ruins underwater, they would find a whole lot more than I found.
All right, let's change horses just a second, and I want to talk briefly about the December 21st, 2012 scenario that we all have facing us coming up as a result of the Mayans. What do you think is going to happen, Graham, when that day comes? Is it going to be like the Y2K scenario where we're all going to be panicking and whatever and nothing happens? Or do you think something's really legitimate about this?
I think there's something legitimate about it, exactly what it's going to come to, nobody can really say. The Maya are not alone amongst ancient cultures in the world in viewing history in a certain way. That there was a period in the past when there was a golden age, that this golden age was brought to an end by a cataclysm, that mankind fell, rose up again, and was destroyed again by a cataclysm, fell back again to a primitive state, forgetting everything, became a species with amnesia, and then rose up again. And this view of history is found in ancient civilizations and cultures all around the world. It's a cyclical view of history rather than a direct straight line. And it's a view that what goes around comes around, that there have been a sequence of cataclysms that strike the earth and reduce civilization to rubble, so that we just have to start again. Plato, who passed down to us the myth of Atlantis, put it very nicely, that we have to begin again like children, with no memory of what went before. And this is really what's of concern about the Mayan calendar, because the Mayan calendar marks a clear end date for civilization as we know it. And in doing so, it draws upon a vast fund of knowledge that lay behind the mysterious Mayan civilization of Central America. And that end date is the 21st of December, the winter solstice, right. 2012. And there are specific astronomical observations. I have to pay tribute to the work of John Major Jenkins in this respect. Specific astronomical configurations that are going to take place on that date. The sun on the winter solstice will be rising against the background of the center of our galaxy, of the center of the Milky Way. And somehow, thousands of years ago, the Maya were able to calculate this forward in time and say to us, that is a signal that the world is coming to an end, and that signal is fast approaching, and we are in the period now when the Maya predicted the end of the world. Now, as I've mentioned, this was a remarkable civilization. They had superior astronomy. Their calendar, based on thousands of years of observation, was actually more accurate than the calendar that we use in Western culture today. And so when a culture like that says that some great cataclysm is going to strike the Earth on a particular date, I think the least we should do is listen to them. We don't absolutely have to go around wearing sandwich boards ourselves saying that the end of the world is nigh, but we should listen and we should take it into account in what we're doing. Now, there's a more positive side to the Maya cataclysm, because what they're suggesting is that a former world, yes, comes to an end, but that a new world is born.
Right.
That out of the ruins of the old arises a new, perhaps a new form of human consciousness is waiting in the wings to be born, which will no longer have patience with this world that we have built, and with the indeed the catastrophes and cataclysms that our civilization is already unleashing upon the world. It's also interesting, when you look at ancient traditions about this, that every one of them, whether it's the story of Atlantis, whether it's the flood of Noah in the Bible, every one of these traditions, and there's thousands of them from all around the world, implicates humanity itself in the disaster that strikes us. And
right.
I must say, in mythological terms, when I look at our society today, I look at a society that would be described in mythological terms as a soon-to-be lost civilization. Because in every possible way, we have angered the gods, we have lost the mandate of heaven, we have abused the privilege of stewardship of this planet. And that is the arrogance of Atlantis, and that is the arrogance that could indeed bring our civilization to its knees, and perhaps surprisingly quickly. So yes, I do take what the Maya had to say extremely seriously.
I have a quick follow-up question. Where do you think the Mayans got this information from about this warning about 2012?
I think, personally, this is my view. I've backed it up in books like Fingerprints of the Gods, is that it all goes back to a former civilization. that there was in the world, living around the coastal margins, more than 12,000 years ago, a highly advanced culture, a culture that was capable of mapping the whole world, because one of the legacies they've left us are a series of ancient maps that actually show the world as it looked during the last ice age. And if you're going to explore and map the whole world, then you're a pretty advanced civilization. And that civilization, memorialized, for example, in the myth of the so-called myth of Atlantis, was destroyed by a gigantic cataclysm. There were survivors. They sought to establish themselves at various locations around the world, and they passed down a tradition and a memory and a warning of what happened before and what will return again. And I think the Maya were the inheritors of that ancient system of knowledge.
Well, then that actually kind of makes sense, because if I recall correctly, in La Venta, Mexico, they have those huge heads, which I believe are called the Olmecs or something
like that. The Olmec heads.
Yes.
Absolutely extraordinary.
And yes. I mean, they have the facial features of Africans and other yes. cultures. And it doesn't make sense to me how they could be there in Mexico.
Yeah, exactly. When we realize that they're thousands of years older than the time when Africa and the New World were supposed to have come into contact, in other words, at the time of Columbus. These Olmec heads go back thousands of years before that. They're gigantic stone sculptures, and they do most definitely represent African individuals. So they are also a testament to a lost period of history, some connection between the New World and Africa that goes back deep into prehistory, memorialized in those gigantic sculptures. And it's just a huge series of unexplained mysteries like these. The mystery of the Great Pyramid of Giza, for goodness sake. I mean, you know, 6 million ton monuments, perfectly, perfectly oriented to true north, south, east, and west.
Right.
I mean, within a tiny fraction of a single degree, almost space age accuracy. No
right.
modern architect could do it.
No.
And this building is supposed is one of the according to conventional history, it's one of the oldest buildings standing in Egypt. There's no background to it. It just comes out of nowhere. And they, you know, they're putting it at the date of 2500 BC, but what I'm suggesting is that the knowledge that is expressed in the Great Pyramid must go back much, much earlier than that and have been brought to the fore again at the time of that construction project. You know, you don't see hundreds of years of preparation to build the Great Pyramid. It's like somebody just switches on a light and there it is. And so it's a series of mysteries like this that lead me to suspect that we have got a huge forgotten episode in human history. We are a species with amnesia. And until we get to grips with this aspect of our past, you know, we're not going to be able to move forward to the future. You know.
Yeah, I think some of us have more than just amnesia, Graham.
Dave can't remember what he had for breakfast yesterday.
Indeed, yes, I know.
Yeah, I'm 59. I wake up in the morning, look in the mirror and go, who the hell is that, you know?
Who's that one? Yeah, I have that experience too, yeah.
This is Bob. He's a hard-working 30-something male that is well-liked at the office. But Bob is hiding a secret affliction that he's hidden all his life. You see, Bob suffers from what has just been recently diagnosed as politicus uneducatus. Fortunately for Bob and millions of sufferers like him, there is help available for the politically uninformed. And it's available free 24 hours a day to anyone connected to the internet. All Bob has to do is type in www.abovepolitics.com and his disease soon will disappear completely. With Above Politics, Bob can now be informed in what's happening not only with the U.S., but also in the worldwide politics arena. It doesn't matter if it's liberal, conservative, socialized, moderate, or other, Bob can't help but become better educated. He'll soon be up to speed on important issues on topics like the economy, military and security action, energy and science, religious and spiritual influences. And when it comes to finding out the latest on the political players' motivation and sentiments, Bob now will know the difference from the left and the right and everything in between. If you cringe at political discussions around the water cooler like Bob does, grab a pen and paper now and write this web address down. www.abovepolitics.com. It will change your life forever.
You know, another thing that you and I have a great passion about is the conceptual idea of transdimensional beings. Tell me a little bit about your philosophy on that.
Well, this has really become a central issue for me as I have worked with this South American sacred plants called ayahuasca, which have enabled me to experience directly the reality of other dimensions and of beings that inhabit them. Now, I'm prepared to accept that that's not what they are, but that is how I have experienced them and how many, many other people I know who've worked with this mysterious shamanistic brew have experienced them, that we live in a multidimensional universe, that all around us, all the time, a much wider reality than we are able to see interpenetrates our own.
Right.
That in the normal, alert, problem-solving state of consciousness of everyday life, we just cannot know or experience or see those other dimensions. And quantum physicists are trying to build gigantic machines in order to break into parallel dimensions, like the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva, Switzerland, the largest scientific instrument of the planet, billions of dollars worth of investment, primarily to find out whether we can get into these other dimensions that quantum physicists already are convinced exist. And what I've come to realize is it's probably a whole lot simpler than that. We have the instrument inside our heads right now.
Right.
It's called our brains. And what we have to do is to adjust our state of consciousness, just as I mentioned earlier, just as you would retune a TV set to pick up a different signal. All those other signals are out there broadcasting, but in order to gain access to them, we have to change our level and state of consciousness. And shamans in traditional cultures all around the world are the masters of the technology to do that. And it's a psychic technology, a technology of altering consciousness. Can be done with powerful hallucinogenic plants, can also be done with certain kinds of music, with rhythmic dancing, with fasting. There are all kinds of different techniques that shamans have developed to change the receiver wavelength of the brain,
right,
and allow us to make contact with other realities. And I think this is one area where Western civilization really needs to sit at the feet of traditional cultures and learn from them. Because as the late, great Terence McKenna said, the shamans of tribal and hunter-gatherer cultures around the world have kept the flame of a tremendous mystery burning, while our society persists in believing that there is no mystery. This is one of, to my mind, one of the worst things about the dominance of science in Western civilization. Science is a brilliant thing. It's a wonderful system for manipulating and exploring the physical realm. But right, if by chance there is more to reality than the physical world, science is not the right instrument for exploring it. And the techniques of shamanism developed over thousands of years, I believe, are the right instrument. And I've been trying to learn from those techniques,
right,
over the last several years. And I've had some extraordinary experiences that have changed my view of reality and changed my outlook on my own life as well.
Well, there is something that has always kind of perplexed me as I want to try to move into a biblical area, if you don't mind. In the Bible, supposedly the Israelites, while they were wandering in the desert for all those many 40 years, the only form of sustenance that they had was supposedly this stuff called manna, or orme, I believe as the Hebrew call it, or translated, what is it? Have you ever been able to decide what this substance is? Does it exist today? Could it possibly be this monatomic white gold that we hear about?
You know, I don't really have a strong view on manna. When the Israelites were wandering in the wilderness of Sinai after the departure from Egypt, some very extraordinary things took place, or at least so we are assured in the book of Exodus and
right,
other books of the Old Testament that cover this period. Where I developed an interest in this period specifically concerns the Ark of the Covenant. I've written
right,
a whole book about the Ark of the Covenant, the sign and the seal. And I had to explore the early origins of the Ark of the Covenant. And I do trace those origins back, although I accept that some Christian listeners might not agree with me on this. I do trace those origins back to ancient Egypt and to the high magic and science of ancient Egypt. And the reason I trace them back there is to do with the figure of Moses. Moses led the Israelites through Sinai, but Moses was also brought up in the household of the Pharaoh and groomed to be a future Pharaoh himself. This means that he would have been given access to the secrets of all of the ancient magic and wisdom of Egypt. I think those secrets explain the extraordinary powers of the Ark of the Covenant and its ability to strike people dead with bolts of fiery energy. And I suggest that that knowledge rooted in the past of ancient Egypt also explains the mystery of mana, that we are dealing with a kind of lost technology here.
Hmm. Okay, I'm going to we're going to kind of intermingle some questions from the AboveTopSecret.com membership in addition to our own things. Just kind of get some member questions in here. And this one, Graham, is from a member by the name of Space Visitor, who has seen your video, The Secret of the Pyramids, and he says he was very, very impressed with it and was really enthralled with it. His question basically deals with the curse of the Pharaoh. Space Visitor says that the poison taken from the hair spines of whatever the cactus name is, poison lasts for 1,000 years. The pharaohs knew their graves would be robbed. They put their hairs on their body wraps, et cetera, et cetera. His question is there any way to authenticate, especially when you're talking about going to King Tut's tomb and all the things that have been found in the pyramids, is there anything to substantiate the curse of the pharaohs?
Well, I personally don't think that it has anything to do with a long-lasting poison. But I think we have to understand that the ancient Egyptians were a most extraordinary civilization. Really very unusual. They maintained a peaceful and harmonious prosperity for more than 3,000 years. During that whole time, they devoted their best minds to exploring the mystery of life after death. The tombs that were created for deceased individuals were seen as the homes for a particular aspect of the deceased individual's soul. The soul in the ancient Egyptian system was a very complex entity, but one part of it remained in the tomb. And to desecrate the tomb was to bring down on yourself an attack effectively from this ghostly spirit of the entity buried in that tomb. This is what the ancient Egyptians believed. And they knew a whole lot more about what they were talking about in these matters than we do, because we don't devote our best minds to considering mysteries like that.
Right.
We devote our best minds to making, you know, new products to sell in the supermarket.
There is another member by the name of Luis9343 who says, "You present great similarities about ET encounters and the supernatural state obtained by consuming hallucinogens. Sometimes masses of people see UFOs. So do you then contend that they all enter a hallucinatory state at the same time?"
Very good question. And of course, I do have an answer to that question.
What I hope so, because we're
glad to hear
what
that.
what I'm talking about in my book is altered states of consciousness, however those altered states are produced. That an altered state of consciousness is necessary in order to see supernatural realms and beings, to have contact with them. And one of the efficient ways of getting into an altered state of consciousness is via hallucinogenic plants, as shamanic cultures have done for thousands of years. But there are other ways to get into altered states of consciousness. And magnetic fields are particularly powerful producers of altered states of consciousness. Michael Persinger at the Laurentian University in Canada is producing profound altered states of consciousness by beaming powerful electromagnetic fields at the heads of his volunteers. And the moment the field hits their brains, they start to see visions and to see small beings standing around them. And that's what I'm suggesting happens when large groups of people all see the same the same object, which is that they are all affected by an electromagnetic field, which affects their consciousness, effectively retunes their consciousness, and allows them to see that which is not normally visible. the miracle of Fatima in Portugal, right, when 70,000 people, as well as an encounter with the Virgin Mary, saw what absolutely sounds like a flying saucer, moving through the heavens. I would suggest that all of those people were in a deeply altered state at that point. And that doesn't mean that what they were saying was not real. I'm not saying that what was seen is an illusion. I'm saying it is real, but that it isn't normally accessible to our senses. We have to alter our state of consciousness in order to make it accessible to our senses.
Right. Well, for some 25 plus years, off and on, I have been an amateur UFO researcher, and I've gone to a number of different spots where, between photography, film, and also video cameras, I have captured some unusual things that were in the air. Now, would that still fall under the same category, or am I actually seeing a real phenomena, or is it just
This is where it really gets extremely interesting. The great psychologist Jung wrote a book about flying saucers, and he talked about this very mystery, the mystery of the flying saucer. It's this, that it has largely psychic characteristics, but that it appears sometimes to materialize within our dimension. He actually referred to flying saucers as materialized psychisms for this reason, that occasionally they will actually leave a trace on a camera film or on a radar screen, that people who are abducted by these beings sometimes find objects stuck under their skin which come back with them into this world. Yeah. I think flying saucers, the UFOs, are absolutely real. I just don't think that it's as simple as these things coming across huge distances of interstellar space to explore our planet.
Right.
I think it's much more likely to be some kind of interdimensional technology. We, on this planet, are able to explore other dimensions by altering our state of consciousness. It may be that beings in other dimensions have found a technology to actually break through physically into our realm.
Right, yeah.
And do so from time to time. But my own strong intuition is that it's a much more complicated and a much darker mystery than just beings like us who happen to be from other planets far, far away. I think there's a lot to suggest that we're looking at interdimensional contact here.
I've always considered this. You know, here we are, mere humans, and we will send out into space probes like the Surveyor to orbit the moon or to go to Mars. I've always been curious if there might be a multidimensional race or entities that are doing the same, that have found a way to be able to send their probes into our dimension, and that is perhaps what it is that we see and photograph.
That's what I'd put my money on, personally. That's what's going on here, that there's a range of technologies for jumping between dimensions. We on planet Earth have not yet developed a physical technology to do that, but we can shift our consciousness. We can project our consciousness into other dimensions, but we can't send a machine into other dimensions.
Yeah.
It may be that the inhabitants of other dimensions are able to send their machines into ours. And in fact, I go into this at great length in my book, Supernatural. I'm also suggesting that the mysterious phenomena, the mysterious beings called fairies and elves in medieval Europe, were also interdimensional travelers, perhaps the very same interdimensional travelers, just seen through different cultural spectacles. And just as the modern so-called aliens have the flying saucer as their vehicle for jumping between realms, in the case of the fairies and elves, it was a kind of dance. They did a sort of circular dance. They were often reported as being seen dancing in a circle, and then suddenly they would disappear, completely vanish. If a human being walked up to that circle where the fairies were dancing and touched it, he would be dragged into a vortex and carried off and would disappear also. He might think that he'd been away for a day. He would return a day later. He'd find he'd been gone for 300 years. Rather like the missing time phenomenon on a much wider scale, of course, but rather like the missing time phenomenon that we have today with UFO abductees.
Wow. One of our members is also a super moderator, and his name is Moskwa. And he has an interesting question, and it kind of gets you to give a little bit more information about the shamanism area. And it says, since it is apparent much of what we consider to be the seeds of the best attributes of civilization, he's referring to society, medicine, knowledge, etc., can be traced back to the earliest shamanistic experiences. Do you intend to study, Graham, the traditions of the North American First Nations people as a possible future project?
Yes, very, very much so. I have given some attention to North American traditions in Supernatural, but I did concentrate more, much more on South America, simply because those traditions are much more a part of current practice in South America than they are in North America. And also because I had to draw the lines in my research somewhere. You know, I also largely cut Australia out of my
right.
research. And the Aborigines of Australia have astonishing shamanistic culture and
exactly.
traditions as well. When you're writing a book and it's already a long book, you have to make choices about what you focus on. For those reasons, I didn't focus as much as I would have wished to have done on some of the extraordinary North American traditions in this area. But perhaps for the future, I will. Some of my critics accuse me of writing books that are much too long anyway, you know. So I'd like to draw the line at sort of, you know, 400 or 500 pages and not end up writing 1,000 or 2,000 pages. Because there is a vast amount of just amazing material out there. So you have to make decisions, you have to make choices,
yeah.
and, you know, then you have to do the best you can. My sense as a writer is that my obligation to my reader is to really be there. To really experience
right.
what I'm writing about, to know about it thoroughly and absolutely, to know every side of the argument, to be fully versed on all the academic work and all the alternative work that's been done on the subject as well, and then still, from direct personal experience, to come up with my own point of view. I feel that's my responsibility as an author, but it's probably not my responsibility to know about everything and to write about everything.
A member by the name of Sith Raoul asked this: have you ever been tempted to undertake a more detailed study of the part of the ancient British Isles played in the preserving of forgotten knowledge, or the possible relationship that they may have had with a lost civilization? The Lea Vale, or the Stone of Destiny, that lies in the hills of Tara, or Tara, in Ireland, for example, is clearly comparable with the Omphalos you detailed in Heaven's Mirror.
Yes, I think that there are many mysteries to explore in the British Isles. There is no doubt in my mind that there is a very ancient layer of culture and knowledge here, which goes back far beyond recorded history. And we need only look at the extraordinary stone circles of Britain, Stonehenge, Cullinish in Scotland, the Avebury Stone Circle, which is nearby where I am today, to see in them the remnants of a lost technology and a lost way of knowing the world. I think the problem in Britain, because it's been so plowed over and dug up and built upon over
right.
the last 2,000 years, is that much of the past has been rubbed out, unfortunately. And
yeah.
we don't have a full record anymore. I mean, there was an individual in Avebury, the stone circle near where I live, back in the 18th century, who made it his job to destroy as many of the stones as he could. He built huge fires up against them and then poured acid on them and smashed them up with pickaxes. And, you know, this kind of thing has been going on for thousands of years, whether out of greed, whether out of prejudice. And so a lot of the landscape that contains this information has been carried away, unfortunately.
How terrible.
All right, Above Top Secret member Starry has a pretty interesting question. We haven't really talked about it. She wants to know, or he, if you keep up on all the new findings that are happening on Mars. As an example, she or he wants to know about the liquid water being found on an image taken by the NASA Mars Global Surveyor. Do you think there could be life on Mars, Graham?
Yeah, I'm kind of open-minded about that. I've done a lot of research on Mars, although my main period of focus on Mars goes back to the late 1990s, and I have not been following it as closely since then as I did when I wrote a book called the Mars Mystery. The thing that most strikes me about Mars is that planet was subjected at some point, and I believe possibly quite recently, to a horrendous cataclysm, utterly horrendous, which drew a line all the way around the planet, a line of cliffs, so that one part of the planet, one half of the planet, is physically much lower than the other half. Huge craters, but it looks to me like it was hit by a series of gigantic asteroids. And these would have had such power and such force that they may have been capable of sterilizing all life on the planet. So I have no doubt that there was life on Mars, but whether there still is, I'm not so sure. I still remain completely open-minded to the case that my friend Richard Hoagland and others have made, that there are monuments on Mars. I think that NASA has rubbished this case in an almost suspicious way and much too quickly. Some of the photographic images that have come back from Mars are absolutely intriguing. And even though a huge disinformation campaign was put in around the subject of the so-called face on Mars, so that we were all supposed to become convinced that actually it's not a face, it's just a natural hill.
Right.
I am by no means convinced of that. And I think that even in the most unflattering photographs of that object, there are intriguing features which are very hard to explain in natural geological terms.
We have another member by the name of Undo who asked this question. Is Graham beginning to now subscribe to the idea that the fruit from the tree of life back in Adam and Eve's story was a psychedelic or psychotropic mushroom type fruit?
Yes, in a word, I am beginning to subscribe to that idea. I think the origins, and I realize again that this may offend some listeners, but I think that the origins of all religions lie in shamanistic experiences. And all shamanistic experiences involve altered states of consciousness. So let us consider, for example, Judaism. Moses, before the burning bush, hears a voice emanating from a bush, sees the bush shimmering with light, and the bush speaks to him. Many of those who've had experiences with shamanistic plants will have had a similar experience. St. Paul on the Damascus Road in Christianity, struck down by a blinding light, completely transforms his life from then on in. This is a classic shamanistic death and rebirth with a new mission in life. The Prophet Muhammad in his cave in Arabia, isolated, alone, cold, shivering, a perfect situation to bring on an altered state of consciousness, meets a supernatural being who he construes as the angel Gabriel, who presents to him the entire text of the Quran. These were all, in my view, genuine experiences of the supernatural, which were mediated by altered states of consciousness. Unfortunately, then what happens with all the mainstream religions is that the bureaucrats and the money men step in, and within a few generations, instead of being an instrument of spiritual liberation, the religion has become an instrument of spiritual control. Instead of encouraging people to have direct spiritual experiences, they are saying, no, the priest or the mullah or the rabbi is the only one who may have these spiritual experiences and is the intermediary between us and the supernatural realm. So to cut a long story short, scratch any of the big religions down to its roots, and you are going to find a shamanistic experience of altered states of consciousness.
Right.
These experiences are present in the birth of religion, in the painted caves and the rock art that is found all around the world. There's no doubt that that was the work of shamans in altered states of consciousness. And this is the first evidence we have of any kind of religious behavior amongst our ancestors. So nobody can deny that these states of consciousness have been fundamental in the development and origins of religion. And therefore, our society, if we value religion, we should value these experiences also and realize what a crucial, massive, gigantic role they have played in the human story. And we should stop pretending otherwise.
I want to go into something I know you have a real passion about. I know a lot of your work has to do with your Orion correlation theory. Could you tell our listeners something about what you believe is the Orion correlation theory?
Okay, well, first of all, I must make absolutely clear that this is not my theory. This is the theory of a close colleague and indeed co-author of mine, and that is Robert Bovall.
Yes, that's right.
Robert Bovall is an engineer by training, and he spent much of the first half of his adult life building enormous structures all over the Middle East, as a matter of fact. But Robert one day became intrigued by the pyramids, the three pyramids of Giza. And looking at an aerial photograph, he wondered why they were laid out on the ground in such a peculiar manner. And to cut the long story again, very short, after years of research, Robert was absolutely able to establish why the pyramids are laid out in the form they are on the ground. And that's because they are designed as an image on the ground of the three stars of the belt of the constellation of Orion. Three pyramids, three stars, and the pyramids laid out on the ground in the pattern of the stars. And it turns out that the constellation of Orion isn't just any old constellation. If you wanted to argue that this astonishing visual resemblance was a coincidence, that would be a lot easier if you could say, well, look, the constellation of Orion wasn't important in ancient Egypt. But on the contrary, the constellation of Orion was the most important constellation in the sky for the ancient Egyptians.
Right.
And they regarded it as the image in the sky of their god of death and rebirth, Osiris, and that the stars represented his belt. So it's very natural that they would seek to make an image of the kingdom of Osiris in the sky on the ground, because Osiris was the lord of the dead. He governed the underworld. It was he who one had to come to terms with when making the journey, the afterlife journey that the Egyptians believed we go through, and they believed that we should be prepared for that journey. So I think what they were doing at Giza was creating a gigantic three-dimensional model of the region of the sky through which they believed their souls would travel after death.
One of my questions that I wanted to ask is also mirrored by one of the members' questions, which was by JPM1602. I'll just combine mine with that member's. Is there any hard skeletal scientific fact or remnants that giants exist? And what's with the crystal skulls that should not have been able to been made by the given tools of that time period?
As to giants, I've yet to see evidence of any real giants in the past of the human story. Of course, we only find a tiny fraction of the skeletal remains that are laid down in any epoch. But we got a pretty clear view of the evolution of human anatomy over the last 6 million years from the last common ancestor with the chimpanzee.
Right.
I'm not aware of any gigantic human remains which are not a hoax. And I do feel quite strongly about that. The moment another turn of the spade reveals the skeleton of a giant and it proves to be genuine, I will accept it. But up till now, I haven't seen any evidence of that. Now, remind me of your second part of your question.
The member wanted to know about the crystal skulls. How could they
the
have been created?
The crystal skulls, yes. The crystal skulls, again, we have this category of out-of-place artifacts that have come down to us from prehistory, which don't fit into the picture of the technology of the past. And my argument all along has been we have to accept that we've forgotten part of the story, that there was a period of high technology in the past, which has been forgotten because a great cataclysm came and destroyed that civilization. And I think that the technology that goes to the creation of the crystal skulls is as mysterious as the technology that lies behind the pyramids of Egypt, and that both of them are likely to have their origins in a lost civilization of prehistory.
This is from member Copernicus, and he doesn't have a question. He just says, Graham, I don't want to ask you anything. I just want to tell you that I think you're one of the bravest men who have continued to tell the truth as you see it, despite being threatened and hated by some people who are still stuck in an illusionary world. So that's just giving you a compliment that he's very...
Thank you. It's enormously encouraging. And it is really nice and heartening to hear that kind of comment, because it does... it can be quite difficult to be taking a line that the mainstream of academia and their friends in the media completely disagree with, and you do end up getting attacked, and it is tough. So it's nice to hear that there's that support out there.
Well, you have tons of members that are I'll give you an example. It is one of the most responded to interview things that we have put up since the inception of the ATS Mix Show.
We're glad to hear it.
Yeah, we're going into our 50th show. So you have a ton of fans, and with all the posts that were made, all the questions that were made, we definitely want to again thank the membership of AboveTopSecret.com for jumping in here. So here's my last question. Now I'm going to throw it to John for his last question with you, Graham. We appreciate your courtesy and time with us this evening. But this is member Above Top Secret Schuler. And he wants to know, have you found any additional information since you wrote Underworld?
I have a tendency when I've finished a book to move on. Underworld involved me in 7 years of scuba diving all around the world with my wife, Santa, who's a photographer. We put our lives on the line again and again and again. I can't tell you the number of times that we nearly died in that research, whether carried away by huge currents flowing like a river underwater, whether surfacing and finding one's boat gone, just a huge range of problems, storms, being borne down on by a ferry and hardly able to get out of the way. I really took it as far as I could possibly take it, and I tried to put everything into the book. After I finished that book, I felt that there wasn't much more that I could add to it, and I kind of hope that others will take the research on. You know, I'm getting older now. I'm 57.
As we all are.
Yeah,
as we all are.
We're right with you, brother.
and although I still love diving, I felt I risked my life enough for that project.
Oh yeah.
And I hope that others will take it on.
I don't want to end this on a negative note or anything, but this is something that I feel that perhaps needs to be done. And so I want to present this to you, Graham, because you do have a lot of fans at AboveTopSecret.com and the worldwide, but there are also some of those that don't necessarily agree with your out-of-the-box thinking concepts. And so I'd like to give you the chance right now to maybe answer to those. What would you say to those that are accusing you of being part of, say, a conspiracy agenda, and that your investigative work is just part of some disinformation with the only goal to promote a new belief system? I'm going to give you this period right now to address those people.
Well, obviously, if people do have such beliefs about me, there's nothing that I can do to convince them. Basically, the way I see it, I'm a simple reporter, and I happen to have an interest in ancient mysteries, and I've taken my reporting and investigation skills as a journalist and applied them to the field of ancient mysteries. I always try to set out the facts and the evidence on which I draw my conclusions. I try to provide full transparency to the readers. I do wear my heart on my sleeve. I take risks for my stories. I put myself out there. I argue my corner. I'm always willing to accept that I might be wrong. I think that my job is to provide an alternative point of view. And I would emphasize it's a minority point of view. I am not with the mainstream on almost anything. I'm always trying to give the other side of the story. And I think there's a need in our society for giving the other side of the story. And I don't think that needs to be seen as a conspiracy. I hope in the long term it'll be seen as a useful function, and that I did something useful with all of these years of work.
Well, if it wasn't for challenges and out-of-the-box thinking, we'd still be believing that we lived on a flat world.
Yes, indeed. And in fact, many still do believe that.
And that is actually true.
I have a neighbor that still believes that.
Yes, it's really quite extraordinary, but there you are. Beliefs are very hard to change once they set in.
Well, I can't tell you what a pleasure it's been for Dave and I to have you on our show, Graham. And we want to thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule, sir.
Thank you. It's been fun for me, too. I've really enjoyed talking to you guys. Thank you for having me on the show.
And we want to ask you, if you would, to just stay on as we close this out, and we'll do our proper goodbyes off air. So in the meantime, we want to thank once again Graham Hancock for taking time out to be on our interview with Dave and Johnny. This is the ATS Mix. I am Johnny Anonymous.
And I am Dave Rabbit. And on behalf of all the members at AboveTopSecret.com who have contributed to the great questions for Mr. Graham Hancock, we definitely appreciate all of you. So we'll see you next time on the ATS Mix. Hi, everybody. Dave Rabbit here with the ATS Mix Show from AboveTopSecret.com. When I get ready to relax after doing a long show, I enjoy going to our sister site, BelowTopSecret.com. They have some great forums there, some of which include rants, jokes, puns, and pranks, which is one of my favorites, faith and spirituality, relationships, travel and vacations. They even have a freshman forum for you newbies and rookies. I especially enjoy the music, television, fantasy, and science fiction forums, as well as comics, music, member art, and, of course, video games.
But my absolute all-time favorite is Cool Websites. And I want to tell you why. As everyone knows, I do not read. On Cool Websites, the membership at BelowTopSecret.com has done the work for me. They've researched the World Wide Web and found very interesting sites. All I got to do, go into the forum, click, and I am at an interesting and very cool website. So when you get through listening to that last ATS Mix show, come join me at BelowTopSecret.com, part of the Above Network LLC. Remember, deny boredom, BelowTopSecret.com.
ATS Mix from AboveTopSecret.com is over.
You've been listening to the ATS Mix with Dave Rabbit and Johnny Anonymous. If you have a comment, suggestion, an opposing view, or would like to participate in a future show of ATS Mix, please contact Dave or Johnny at www.AboveTopSecret.com. The views expressed on ATS Mix do not necessarily reflect those of the staff and management of the Above Network, LLC, or any of its affiliates. Thanks for listening. You may now reattach your tinfoil hat. Thank you.